Of Troy Noons is an absolute podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hey, we won a basketball game.
We did. First time in a while, and I'd say probably the longest this team has gone in 40 years between Jim Boeheim wins, which is troubling.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just with, even with not Johnny Boeheim, it's been since December 27th, which is bizarre and unfortunate. But, you know, we looked really good yesterday. Obviously, BC being BC helps part of that. But I think at this point, we're all ready to win any game. So glad to be back on the right side of things, at least for a week.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's see if it's even a week. I know we have the game coming up on Saturday.
At least for a couple days.
Dan, what was the, I guess, what was the biggest positive for you coming out of that game? I mean, obviously, to get a win, I think, is just good from a psychological standpoint for a young team. But was there something in particular that just really stuck out to you as a harbinger of maybe some better things to come for the Syracuse squads?
It was nice to see Mike Benajay kind of bounce back from, he had the really rough game against UNC and had kind of been in a little bit of a slump. So seeing him come back, not his best game ever, but you know, shot 5 for 8 from the field, which is pretty good. Rebounded the ball well, got a bunch of steals, scored 14. So it was a nice bounce back performance, and we didn't need him to be a star just because BC couldn't score at all. And then Malachi Richardson just having a really, really good ACC season so far, and definitely looks like a guy who's going to be able to contribute in a big way, you know, for the balance of the year. He's been in double digits since that Texas Southern game. He scored 20 against Miami, 21 against Clemson. He played well against UNC, scored 16. So he's been playing really well at a really high level. Actually, this whole year, there's only been three games where he's been under double, you know, he's had fewer than double digit points. So, you know, at first, obviously, we were all about Tyler Lydon. He's kind of tapered off a little bit for various reasons, but Richardson's really turning into the player, probably at the upper end of what we thought he could be as a freshman this year, which is exciting.
Yeah, you know, I think Richardson provides a unique kind of perspective for a freshman player anyway. I think that, you know, in recent years we've seen a lot of high hopes for freshmen. I think ever since Carmelo and Jerry, there's been a lot of high hopes for you know, highly touted freshmen. And, you know, while we've seen different levels of success and high-level success, I think that Richardson's been one of the more consistent ones in recent years. And, you know, like you said, at first he was kind of overshadowed by Lydon, in portions overshadowed by Benajay, both of them being, you know, primary scorers. But Richardson's really played pretty consistently and shown, I think, in the last couple of games that when he's taking smarter shots and not just, you know, being a volume shooter, as he sometimes can, you know, get roped into, you see a high quality player with a good basketball IQ and someone who really, you know, has the type of athleticism to play both inside and out. And I mean, I don't want to start worrying about whether he leaves or not. I don't think we can afford to have anyone else leave earlier than intended, but that conversation could be for another day. But for now, I think, you know, Richardson's really rounding into a great player, and I think him learning under guys like Benajay and Cooney can only stand to benefit his career.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is he came in with a reputation as being this like deadly shooter, and he's had games where he's been really dangerous from three, especially in that Clemson game, he went crazy. But Clemson and Miami, he had two ridiculous shooting nights. Overall for the season, like, he's shooting 33%, which is fine. I think that'll go up as he becomes more comfortable. But the fact that he's put the ball on the ground on the floor as effectively as he has is super, super impressive. Does that, you know, we saw him do it at the high school level, but it seemed like the shooting was going to be the ability that translated directly. And he's been a fine shooter, but his ability to get to the hoop, I don't think many expected it to be as big a part of his game as it has been.
Agreed. And you know what? I think the other big part of yesterday, and this is something that we harped on a ton when he was out for a few games, is you know, the emergence of Frank Howard. I know point guard's kind of been a point of contention all season. Obviously, we've kind of rotated in several different players, but Frank Howard just really seemed to, you know, provide exactly what we needed at the position in yesterday's game. He played 14 minutes there, And while he didn't put up any points and really didn't rack up, you know, assists, I just think he provided a certain amount of consistency to let, you know, Benajé operate off ball and really kind of, you know, be what he is, which is a scorer rather than the, you know, facilitator he was kind of forced to be over various stretches in the early part of the season.
Yeah, he hasn't put up big numbers yet. His most points in a game is 6 against Texas Southern. But I just think the offense looks like it doesn't really lose a major step with him in there, like you said. And it also puts Mike Benajé in more of an offensive role. And you can kind of plug him in with a number of different players. So I think the actual scoring and him making plays will come. But it definitely, it's nice to be able to plug him in for 5-10 minutes and not really worry about the team going into a giant slump, because he seems to be able to run the offense effectively, which is important.
Yep. I guess moving a little bit, you know, into some of the big men, Dewan Coleman probably had his best game in a little while. But do you think this was just kind of a one-off for him? I mean, obviously Dennis Clifford is a quality center for BC, but do you think this is maybe the game he needed to kind of get his confidence back, stay out of foul trouble by and large, and, you know, maybe, you know, put this into a couple consecutive double-digit efforts, even if the rebounds still sort of were lagging and behind?
I think he's been impressive. I think against UNC as well, you kind of saw the difference when he was out of the game. But the fact that Syracuse out-rebounded UNC, even if it was only by one or two, I think, is super impressive, because they're one of the best rebounding teams in the country, and Syracuse has been one of the worst. So I think he's starting to find his sea legs a bit. He's playing more minutes now. His last two games have been his two biggest games in terms of minutes. The rebounds haven't been, you know, he hasn't had double-digit boards yet, but I think he's rebounding slightly better. But I think the team just overall has more of a presence when he's in there. And if he can chip in 11 points like he did last night, I mean, that's gravy for the Syracuse team, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing notable I saw last night, other than, you know, Coleman playing well and Roberson, although he, you know, got into some foul trouble himself, still seemed to contribute and actually shot reasonably well from the floor, if not the free throw line, where he was, you know, an abysmal 2-for-5. But you didn't see any Chino, and I think that speaks in volumes about where he sits in the, you know, Boeheim hierarchy. That's highly unfortunate, because I've maintained all year, I really do think we need him to be able to be a factor, but unfortunately it just seems like things have kind of fallen apart with Aboko on the floor.
Yeah, and he's really in the, like, break in case of emergency glass, DeShante Riley position, which, I mean, it would be great if we had a legitimate backup center, but clearly, I mean, his numbers didn't really change much with Hopkins coaching the team, and I feel like Hopkins was a little more aggressive in terms of trying out new rotations and trying out new players. I think you saw Coleman's role expand a little bit with Hopkins. I think you saw Howard's, until he got sick, expand with Hopkins. Chino, not really. So I think this is just going to be it just doesn't seem like they have any confidence in him kind of maintaining the level of play at the center position, even for 5 minutes at a time, which is unfortunate, because if you could get 5 to 10 minutes out of him, it would make a world of difference, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, this has been a kind of, you know, point of consternation over the last couple of years, is that only having one center and maybe a power forward you can switch into that spot has definitely been problematic for Syracuse. It's been problematic on the boards, problematic for scoring, foul trouble, etc. And to have Aboko, a guy who should be able to rebound at least a little bit, out, has definitely been a detriment. Last kind of note from that game, and this is not just this game related, but I think several games now. What's going on with Tyler Lydon? Like you said, he started the year hot. He was getting all the accolades. He was getting stupid amounts of, you know, draft lottery talk and all this other stuff. And he's really come back down to earth. What do you think it is? You think for Lydon, it's just, is it exhaustion? Is it just defense is really keying in on him? I mean, obviously he's a versatile player, so you can't necessarily just harp on one part of his game, but what do you think has been bugging, you know, Lydon the most over probably the last, like, couple weeks?
I think Boeheim was pretty spot on. He said, teams finally realized who he was and what he could do, because Lydon, you know, he's a four-star recruit, but he wasn't nearly as touted as Richardson was. He was, you know, from a small New York town. He really burst onto the scene his last year, but I don't think many expected him to have the role that he even does now on this team. And then, obviously, in Atlantis, he just totally blew up and had some huge games against Charlotte, UConn, and Texas A&M. So I think the ACC programs have just kind of taken notice and aren't going to let him beat them. And I think he has done a little cold. I think there's definitely a confidence issue. You kind of see it when he catches the ball. He just doesn't go up with the, you know, assurance that he's going to knock down the shot. But he'll dip through it. I mean, he's a young player. He's playing a lot of time out of position. Not quite as much because Coleman's been able to handle a little more of the load the last couple of games. But I think we're going to, you know, have some ups and downs with him just as a freshman. Luckily, I think we can put the him going to be a one-and-done stuff to rest if that was ever a legitimate concern, which I don't think it really was. But I'm not worried about him long-term. I just think, you know, we probably got more out of him early on than we should have, and we're probably getting a little less than we should now. Hopefully it balances out by the end of the year, and he's kind of back to being, you know, the threat that he was early in the season as he, you know, gains a little more confidence and a little more experience playing against good competition.
That's very good perspective. And yeah, I think he's probably averaging into the player that we thought, but now we just need him to be that average player. So hopefully that continues. Moving on to this weekend, like we both said, you know, it was a great win against BC, but there's not really a ton you can extrapolate out from that game when you're facing one of the worst Power 5, if not the worst Power 5 program in the country. Wake Forest, not great, but not bad either. Sneaky good, I would contend. They had that signature win over Indiana from earlier in the year. They beat LSU. They have lost in not really impressive fashion to teams like Duke, like Louisville, like Vandy. What do you make of Wake Forest, and what challenges do you think that they bring against Syracuse this Saturday, especially for a nooner, which is never a great sign, especially on the road for SU?
I think sneaky good's a good way to describe them. Like you said, they beat Indiana, which, you know, you can knock Tom Crean's coaching ability, but he does bring talent in, so it's a nice-looking win. They kept things fairly close in Louisville. Xavier, they beat LSU, although that's not nearly as impressive as it probably seems because LSU just, like, can't quite figure it out outside of Ben Simmons. They beat NC State. They just lost to Virginia Tech, who's also, like, sneaky getting better. So they're, you know, a pretty standard mid-level ACC team, but I think the ACC overall is a deeper lead this year than it has been. Looking at what Clemson's been doing, and I don't think Clemson's overly talented. I think they just play really, really tough. I think it's definitely another team that we should sleep on. Devin Thomas has been rock solid for them, averaging almost 17 and 10. I think Cody Miller-McIntyre has only played a couple games. He's, you know, been their best player for a couple of years. He's kind of getting rounded into form after going down with an injury to start the season. There's obviously Constantinos Minoglou, who we know all about after he torched us last year, I believe. So it's a team with some interesting players. I think they're fairly well coached under Danny Manning. And I do agree. I think it's going to be a tough one. I don't know if we even have like a lineup or anything, but this is definitely a game where Syracuse can't afford to come out looking sloppy just because it's a road game and it's an early game. I think if that happens, I could see Wake kind of jumping on us.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the early start is killer, especially on the road. I think that, you know, this is a team that shoots well enough from three. Obviously, we saw it last year. We're going to see it again this year. This is a team that, you know, they don't keep control of the ball, you know, amazingly, but I wouldn't say that they're sloppy at all with the basketball. I think Danny Manning, like you said, coaches really well and has this team very improved. I just think we have a work cut out for us. And, you know, this is the first kind of must win. I know we've said that a couple games now. This is the first kind of must win in a lengthy stretch here. We can talk about the article from today and for those listening yesterday, you know, about bad losses and what those really mean. But if Syracuse is going to get past some of those losses in the early going, they need to win games like this against peer programs. Yet Wake is just... I don't think they're necessarily geared to kill us inside, outside of Devin Thomas, but we've seen, you know, lesser teams do more on that front. I think if we can reduce threes and in general just stay out of the stupid mistakes that have really killed us in the recent weeks, I think we stand a good chance to win. But again, this Wake team is tough. They're scrappy, and I think the book is far from written on how to beat them, which is you know, a good sign for any young team with a young coach.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's unfortunate that we have to bring up like how important a game is to the season this early, but I think we're just kind of facing that reality. I wrote it in the roundtable that we did a day or two ago. I think talent-wise, Syracuse has the ability to make the tournament. It wouldn't shock me if they, you know, came out and started winning, you know, all the games that they should, and you know, come play their best basketball come March, and that'd be great. But there's just so little wiggle room now for what this team needs to do in ACC play because of those four losses out of the gate. And granted, I don't, like you wrote today, I don't think any of them is a bad loss. Pitt and Miami have been two of the best teams in the conference so far. UNC obviously is the conference favorite for a reason, and Clemson looks really, really good, and legitimately so. Like, they are 4-1, they've beaten some really good teams. But just starting 0-4, I mean, if you think we have to go 9-9 or 8-10 and do some work on the tournament, like, that's not an easy thing to get to, especially when you still have games against Duke. You have Virginia, you have Notre Dame, you have Florida State, you have another UNC game. So things are definitely stacked against the Orange, but you know, you beat Wake on the road, and that's probably a toss-up game in terms of what the odds will look like and what people outside of Syracuse think. And then you have, you know, two wins heading into that really brutal stretch from Duke to the Duke, UVA, Notre Dame stretch that's coming up, and you hope to steal one of those. But having three wins after that is better than having one, which is a real reality heading into this Wake game.
Agreed. And, yeah, before we get into those losses a little bit more, and said kind of focusing on that article, you mentioned ACC was a much deeper league this year. I mean, is it truly a 14-deep league right now? I mean, obviously there's four at the top, with Pitt kind of lingering right on the outside looking in. But, you know, is this really a 14-deep league at this point? You look at the standings, you see a lot of teams, well, every team with, you know, at least 11 wins now, except for Boston, well, at least 10 wins, except for Boston College. NC State is 10-7. Do you just think that this is a product of the influx of quality coaching, influx of talent, the fact that, by and large, the ACC is able to bring in just better players on a year-to-year basis than any other league because of the venues it plays in, because of the stage it plays on? You know, are we nearing a point where, I know we've debated it before, is this league better than the Big East was at its behemoth days? Or do you think that there's still maybe another step it has to go because it's still only about four, maybe five deep at the top?
I don't think at the top it's quite as strong as even some of these last level ACC teams or some of the or ACC years or the Big East years that we all kind of remember and love. But in terms of depth, I mean, even the bottom of this league, Syracuse is there. I don't think any of us think Syracuse is an outright bad team. Boston College is probably a bad team. I think we can say that kind of safely. Sorry, Eagles. But NC State, you know, they're 10-7. They don't have a win yet in conference. I mean, Cat Barber is one of the best players in the league by far. Maverick Rowan's very good. Abdul Malik Abu is really good. So they have players. Georgia Tech has Marcus Georges Hunt. They have Adam Smith. Like, all these teams that are at the bottom of the league have very talented, like, guys that could make a run for a first or second all-conference team. And that's pretty much across the board. And I don't think the top is quite as good. I think UNC is very good. I think Duke, when they get healthy, is very good. I don't think it's, you know, they're quite at the level of some of these other ACC squads. And, you know, but I think that's kind of how college basketball has shifted this year. I don't think we have a dominant program in the country. And I agree. I don't think there's like a huge gap between, let's say, like the number four or five ACC team and the number 14, or even 15. Like, I think BC is really the, 14. BC is pretty bad. But everyone else, I think, is competitive, and I think all of them are still in some kind of position where they can make a run for the tournament if they go on a streak. And I think all of them have players that can kind of lead that kind of run in the right circumstances.
Agreed. You know, I kind of brought that up because I thought it kind of informed the point about, you know, these losses, and not just these losses that we've suffered, but the ones that, you know, are probably upcoming, or the games that we could potentially turn into wins. This is a brutal stretch. We said this last year when the schedule came out and we saw how it ended. We said this year with a pretty solid stretch from the, you know, beginning of the season outside the BC game. Just a really difficult stretch now with Wake Forest and Duke and Virginia all coming up. So, Dan, going to the article, I said out of the seven losses thus far that there was only one certifiably bad game, and that one was St. John's. It's a bad loss, no matter what the tournament committee says about Mike Hopkins replacing Boeheim and discounting those games a little bit. That one's dead. Do you think the other games all qualify as either not bad or good, or do you think there's still some time for some of those other games to fall into bad and really kind of bite us at the end?
The one I have the hardest time with is Wisconsin, just because, like, on paper they should be a solid team. Obviously, they lost Bo Ryan mid-year, which is, you know, a weird situation, but they have talent, not as much talent as they had on these last two teams where they made, you know, deep runs in the tournament, but it seems like they should have taken, like, a big but not astronomical step back, and they just haven't really found it this season. But again, like, they're kind of like some of these other, like, some of the teams that we were just talking about in the ACC, where it wouldn't surprise me if they start to, you know, find themselves as a team and maybe not make the tournament, but, you know, become a dangerous Big Ten squad down the stretch. That being said, they're not really one now. But again, like I don't think right now you get too worked up over the Wisconsin loss if it wasn't for the fact that a team at the beginning of a string of a lot of these bad losses. But I agree, St. John's is the one. Like, that St. John's seems really bad. And, I mean, they lost to Chaminade, they lost to NJIT. Like, this is just not a quality basketball team for a number of reasons. And the game at the Darden, just, I was there. It was barely as close as the store looked at the end. Like, Syracuse had a chance to get back in it late, but they just, St. John's kind of put their hand on Syracuse's forehead, and Syracuse just couldn't even come close to hitting them with a swing. So, that one is definitely the one that looks bad. Boeheim or not, like you said, it's hard to shake the thought of losing to a team that's having such a bad season like St. John's.
Yeah, and I mean, you know what, Syracuse in I think recent years, and I say recent as in before the 09-10 team was probably good for a miserable loss almost every year prior to that for about a decade. And we saw maybe a 4 or 5 year break from that. I mean, some exceptions, but by and large that. And now I think we're back to it. And yeah, the St. John's game, no matter what position we were in, would still be a black eye just because of who they've lost to. I mean, their RPI is a joke. If you go by ESPN's metrics anyway, it's 181st. Some other metrics are worse. Ken Pom probably says worse. Yeah, the Wisconsin game is the Wisconsin game, the Clemson game, I feel like, kind of tinge how you really view those losses, I would think. Clemson, it's an overtime loss at home. Boeheim was not coaching. But, you know, Clemson is an 11-6 squad. So then that's on the negative side. Their RPI is still over 100. That's on the negative side. But the wins that they've racked up, against, you know, Louisville and against Duke, this is a team that seems like its record isn't indicative of just how talented it is, and I would argue has actually played a tougher schedule than maybe they're being given credit for. I mean, there were several SEC teams on there. The Tigers really kind of challenged themselves a bit, and I'd like to see how they kind of round out by the end. I mean, that one could turn into a quality victory. The Wisconsin one's puzzling because they are 9-9, but outside that, you know, pretty bad loss to UW-Milwaukee and the Western Illinois season-opening loss, and they've lost to quality programs. I mean, take Marquette out, but Purdue, Indiana, Maryland, Northwestern, like, all quality teams, all teams with, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 wins. So yeah, I think the Wisconsin game is tough because it's, I think especially because it was under Boeheim and might hurt us too at the end of the day. But I think those two games in particular could really swing a lot depending on how you and how the committee views them as we enter into February and then March.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting comparison. It's like Wisconsin came into the year with fairly high expectations just coming off of this couple seasons they have, and they've underperformed where Clemson probably didn't have. I mean, they were picked to finish 12th in the ACC, and they're still like kind of hanging around there in the standings because they had some iffy losses early, but they're really rounding into a form where they look like they're either overachieving or they're just far better than we thought. But both probably are like kind of around the same spot. And I think both could be, you know, go a long way to help Syracuse or hurt Syracuse, but I definitely don't mind seeing Clemson start to knock off some of these better teams, because Syracuse, again, they should have won the game. Like, that was a game that SU had at the end, and it doesn't make us feel a lot better, but the committee will look at that if Syracuse is on the bubble, and it would definitely help if the overtime one-point loss to Clemson was to a Clemson team that is also, you know, a bubble or you know, looking decent for the tournament team, rather than, oh, Clemson had some interesting games in the middle of the year but ended up being 19 and 13 and not really being all that close.
Well, that's the one issue that that some people brought up in the comments section, which was, you know, Clemson winning sounds great on paper, but if Clemson keeps winning, Clemson's going to be part of our competition for that bubble spot. And if it comes down to Clemson versus Syracuse, you know, who has the better resume? It could be Clemson just by way of head-to-head, and that would obviously be a nightmare if a one-point overtime loss could be the thing that, you know, breaks us toward the end.
Yeah, I far preferred when we didn't have to worry about these ever.
Yeah, those years where we were getting top four seeds and doing that whole thing, those were much more fun than my at least my freshman year, when everyone and their mom thought we were a tournament team. We were not. I was extremely aggravated, as was pretty much everybody else. Not times we wanted to relive, but one we might have to come tournament time this March.
Yeah, an underrated portion of the 2015 season. No bubble drama whatsoever.
That was arguably my favorite part of the 2015 season. And I guess that, I think that basketball talk kind of takes us to halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking for the past week?
Not a ton. It was a busy couple days. Obviously, we had the College Football National Championship, which meant I was working until 1:30 a.m. And then just been kind of unwinding from that. So really have not had a lot since we last spoke, when I had a decent amount to touch on. So then I'd kick it over to you for the balance.
You'd be surprised. I actually was feeling quite... well, under the weather throughout the weekend in Arizona. So I was just trying to power through, drink minimally, so as not to exacerbate the issue. I did have a few beers, though. Had some stuff in Treehouse that I received from a trustee that I help out in Connecticut. Had Green from Treehouse, an IPA, and also had their Curiosity 23, which was very, very good. Really enjoyed the latter. Had Peeling Out. It's a Dark Sky Brewing. It's a Tangerine Rye IPA. Had that at the Angel's Trumpet Ale House in downtown Phoenix. Also got to stop in at my favorite restaurant in Phoenix, the Arrogant Butcher, to have Nebraska Brewing's Cardinal Pale Ale. Nothing amazing, but it is just a good, solid pale ale to grab at dinner. Also had from Historic Brewing in Arizona, Pie Hole Cherry Vanilla Porter, which lives up to the name and then some. So yeah, much, much briefer list than normal, but still a couple good new things, and hopefully I'm back at it for this week.
Yeah, hopefully the same. I go check out a brewery or something this weekend, now that my my life is, and I'll say unfortunately, without football, because like having, you know, been looking for things to write about the last couple days, definitely miss the season already, which is unfortunate.
Same here. And I was just glad that for me, I got to end the season watching the game in Arizona. It was just a blast. But we can talk about the game for a few. Dan, I mean, obviously, and sorry, listeners, it's going to be a couple minute conversation. And I swear we're going to move on to Syracuse stuff again. Obviously, that onside kick was the real, you know, kind of momentum swing. It ended up not being necessarily a backbreaker for Clemson, but you could, I mean, at least from my point of view, you could kind of feel the air leave the Clemson half of the building. For you watching at home, you know, what was that call like, and what did you, like, what was going through your head, you know, when it happened so spur of the moment?
I think a lot of people touched on this after the game with their various pieces. I know Will Leach wrote about it for Sports on Earth. It was such an anti-Saban thing to do, in a lot of ways, both, like, you don't expect Nick Saban to make basically trick plays like that, calls like that in huge moments of pivotal games. And he hasn't had to, because every other national championship he's had with Alabama has been a blowout. So it was shocking on its face like that, but then even almost more so after the game, when he essentially said, you know, our defense couldn't stop Deshaun Watson, so we didn't want to put them back out there when they were tired. And with Alabama, we're all so unused to them having to resort to David strategies like that, because they're just so much more talented and so much more well-coached and everything else with that, just on almost, you know, game in and game out. And when they lose, it's because of you know, a heroic game from the opposing quarterback, or there always seems to be like an outside factor. In this game, Clemson was just kind of playing with them straight up pretty much the entire game, if not outplaying them. And to see Saban make a call that, A, was both, like, the execution was perfect, but B, that kind of, like, admits, hey, we're Alabama, but we can't just do the things we always do to win games, so we have to actually utilize some outside thinking and play as an underdog for a minute. Was super interesting because it's such a change of identity for them. And I think it actually definitely made the game more exciting, just because it flipped the script. We came in, Alabama was a touchdown favorite. Alabama is the, you know, the dominant program in the sport. And to see them win a game by doing things that they're just totally against their normal identity was pretty thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there were a lot of startling points watching from in person. It was the place was a zoo energy wise on both sides for much of the game, but through three quarters, Clemson fans were, apoplectic in a good way. The place was buzzing, it was electric. You could feel the energy that Clemson was generating. The clock mishaps and all that at the end of the first half didn't really derail them. But yeah, you know, some of the things that Will Leach brought up and others have brought up, the fact that Bama, you know, coached in game, which is a rarity, and really kind of changed the way that their philosophy. I mean, when I saw Derrick Henry just getting stuffed, and this is the Heisman winner behind, you know, one of the best offensive lines in the sport, to see Henry get stuffed repeatedly, to me was very disconcerting. And given how many times the Clemson front, you know, was able to get after. What's his face? Why can't I remember?
Jake Coker.
There it is. For some reason,
he is a very what's his face quarterback, though. That's in your defense.
Jake Coker's name slipped my mind for a second because he is mostly anonymous. Yeah,
he's an Alabama quarterback through and through.
This is true. He didn't look great for most of the day. He was definitely made to look better by OJ Howard and others. But yeah, he kind of made questionable decisions. He really kind of succumbed to pressure pretty quickly. But suddenly, like when you know he was needed, he was able to spot receivers open in single coverage. Receivers were able to get open in single coverage. And to me, it was crazy to see Alabama pivot, because in the previous losses we've seen to teams similar to Clemson, whether it's an Ole Miss or a Texas A&M or the Auburn game, it was just these. It wasn't that Alabama got outplayed. It was that they weren't playing the same game, and it eventually came back to bite them. I think in this one, Alabama understood that Clemson was playing a different game and shifted. I don't know if you've read the Roger Sherman piece on SB Nation today, but it really was a fascinating breakdown. And for anyone who hasn't read it, please do. It's on the SB Nation College Football page. Breaks down the very, very small error that that Nick Saban and his staff identified in the week leading up. They saw game after game that Clemson was lining up for kicks with a decent amount of space open on the right side. They observed the same exact thing in the beginning parts of the game on Monday night. And then finally, you know, by the fourth kick, decided to exploit it. And I thought it was just, again, you know, a really fascinating look at what, you know, what Saban football means and really like what his staff is just so expert at.
I actually hadn't seen that, but I had heard, you know, the strategy behind Adam Rogers' piece. But it's so perfectly Saban. Like, we hear the stories about how on the plane ride home from this game, he was watching film of what? Who knows? Like, what film are you... like, what was that pressing?
What could you possibly be watching?
Unless it's, like, recruiting film for 2017, like, that's half what I expect it to be. But it's just such an impressive job by them. I think one of the most intriguing storylines of this Alabama team, I tweeted about it and I got a pretty decent response. Has anyone ever gone to Alabama and become instantly more interesting and likable outside of Lane Kiffin?
No, because to me, one of the more fun parts of that entire game was seeing his kids showering themselves in confetti.
Well, his daughter was basically like swinging her brother around in confetti. But no, like Lane Kiffin was like, he got fired from USC and everyone took great joy in that because Lane Kiffin doesn't come across super well. And he goes to Alabama where, A, as a college football fan, it doesn't make any sense on its face because he and Saban just seem like such disparate people. And then he goes in, he's been doing, with very limited quarterback play, a really awesome job as coordinator. And I really am a fan of how Kiffin's been calling games because in a lot of senses, and at Alabama, you know, it's happened with him a couple times there. They started Cooper Bateman in that Ole Miss game, which was stupid. But overall, he doesn't overthink himself very much. So last year, you just saw them feeding Amari Cooper the ball as much as possible. This year, Derrick Henry is our best player. Derrick Henry is one of the best running backs in college football. So let's give Derrick Henry the ball 35, 40 times if that's what we need to do. And then in the championship, O.J. Howard's wide open every play, so let's just draw a place for O.J. Howard. Who cares the fact that he only had like 10 catches in the previous month? Like, they just, he seems to identify weaknesses, and rather than trying to too cute or like in those old Madden games where there's always the one play that worked every single time but you get bored of using it so you run other stuff, Kiffin just runs that play and he'll score 80 points on you. So I think he's done a really awesome job at Alabama. It's fun to watch him call for touchdowns before the pass has even been completed. And I'm sure once he gets a head coaching job in the next like year or two, it'll be at somewhere probably a little too big for him, and maybe he'll slip back into the same issues and be insufferable again. But it's definitely an interesting part of these last 2 years of Alabama football because he doesn't seem to fit into that culture at all. But it's done wonders for him, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think that he's an intriguing coach. I think that the time under Saban has done wonders for him because I think it's allowed him to maybe simplify the process. I think what, and that pun intended there, I guess what he fell victim to is, I think, coaching at three heavily scrutinized organizations, you know, the Oakland Raiders, the Tennessee Volunteers, and the USC Trojans, you know, pretty bright spotlights on all three. The Raiders for their futility, Tennessee for their inflated sense of self, and USC for their equally inflated sense of self and money, how they paraded around. And believe me, I love going to Trojans games, and I grew up, other than rooting for Syracuse, I would root for USC pretty heavily when I, like now, didn't sleep. But yeah, I think a lot of it is the product of that. I think if he'd been at other programs, I think if he moves on and maybe... if he went somewhere like a Texas A&M or not Texas A&M, sorry, a Mississippi State, a Louisville, like a place like that, if he doesn't go to like a blue blood program, I think you'd actually see Lane Kiffin succeed at this point because I think a lot of his failures were products of the circumstances he was put in and the things that he thought he was supposed to be, which was, you know, kind of a jerk.
Yeah, it's almost like he fell upwards so quickly in his career where he got that Raiders job probably ended like 15 years too early. And then instead of slipping back to like coordinator ranks, he got the Tennessee job, which is, you know, we don't think of it, but it's one of probably the 15 biggest jobs in the sport. Just they've just been bad for a while. And then he goes from like a 7-6 year at Tennessee to taking the USC job, which is, you know, just a hair below the NFL, if not on that same level. So it's almost like he didn't earn those three jobs. And now he's kind of fallen back to a place where, you know, his career should have progressed him to, which is like the Alabama coordinator gig. And instead of rushing to jump to back up to where he was, it's almost like his career is now naturally progressing the way it should. When he had all that hectic movement as a head coach way too early.
Yeah, you know, I still think that Lane Kiffin turns into a quality head coach in the college ranks. I don't necessarily know if he's cut out for pro. But again, he's such a young coach, you never can tell. I fully expect him within the next couple of years to take over, hopefully, kind of a mid-tier job in a Power 5 program that is either already used to decent success or one that really is kind of looking for a kick in the pants. And I don't necessarily think that's a program like a Minnesota or Purdue necessarily, and based on the Kevin Wilson contract, it won't be Indiana. But, you know, you could definitely see, him at another SEC school, whether it's in Mississippi State or, you know, maybe a Kentucky if things just don't work out there. Who knows? I think it's way too early to project, even though I just finished projecting.
I'm gonna call it. I'm going to say Pat Narduzzi gets a better job. Lane Kiffin gets hired by Pitt, and Lane Kiffin coaches a total of like 8 games at Pitt and then gets hired by the NFL.
The Steelers. who said, oh, well, you know, we were all just hanging out doing nothing on a Saturday in our stadium and thought, actually, no, he's not a Steelers man. That's not his thing. I could see him coaching Los Angeles Rams.
Oh, God. Once they decide that, like, hey, maybe Jeff Fisher's not good. And they realize what happened. We all realized like 4 years ago.
Honestly, if the Rams are gonna take up the personality they should, Lane Kiffin and the asshole version of Lane Kiffin would be the perfect coach for them.
And if Lane Kiffin remains the coach that he is today as the head coach of the LA Rams, I'm drafting Todd Gurley in my fantasy league because he's gonna get about 800 touches.
There it is. All right, so last but not least, Syracuse football. Today, well, technically last night, but officially today, Syracuse named their new tight ends coach, Reno Ferry. Dan, obviously there's a lot of things going on with Ferry. I guess, one, what do you think? And two, do you think this was the best hire for the position?
I have no idea. I don't know much about him at all. I know as much as anyone else does, he's an Army guy, which I think is interesting for a number of reasons. He coached at Akron, which means that, and he was one of the lead recruiters at Akron back apparently when Akron was recruiting well. I don't remember that being a thing, but apparently it was.
When they beat us.
Oh, yeah.
He recruited all of those players.
So he knows how to win in the dome.
Exactly.
That's good.
He's undefeated in the Carrier Dome.
Oh, God. I don't even think he was on that team, but I think that was after he had been,
it
like...
He left in 2010, so he was a member
of
that team.
Oh, so he was on that team. Yeah.
He was with the players, but he was recruiting coordinator from 2005 to 2007, and we lost to them in 2008. So the starters on that team were almost unequivocally players that he recruited.
Great. Always tying it back to that game. And then obviously was the recruiting coordinator and coach at Towson, where I think coach running backs and then receivers, tight ends, and had some good success at both. So, I mean, his resume, you know, it probably doesn't blow you away, but he's done well at the levels he's been at. He's definitely a recruiting guy. I think if you're hiring a tight ends coach, like, he kind of has to be a recruiting guy because it's not really a prominent enough position for most teams to just solely be him coaching up those like 5 guys. So I'm fine with it. I just don't know enough to really have a huge opinion on him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that was my thought last night. I think some people kind of pivoted a little bit afterward, just because the one thing the two people harped on were, well, a couple people harped on, but two things that people harped on were his time with BP in the Gulf of Mexico, that really isn't do anything one way or the other, as well as the fact that he resigned at Akron amid some recruiting violation allegations that never really came to fruition, or if they did, they were dealt with internally. Some people saw those as a little bit of red flags, and obviously people, after the last staff, people don't like to see a glut of guys coming from MAC schools or FCS schools, and Ferry happens to come from both. So that definitely doesn't thrill everyone, but you know what, I think that I've honestly, and again, this is surprising the most, I've been super optimistic, not just because I, you know, I'm trying to prove that I can be positive and optimistic, but also because, you know, this is a new coaching staff that hasn't coached it down at Syracuse, and I want to give them a shot. But this is the first, this is the only move so far that I've haven't had a little bit of pause on, especially when, you know, there were probably a couple other options, both on the Babers tree and otherwise, that might have also filled kind of a similar role. But, you know, again, because we're a private school, we don't really know the money we're working with. And I would bet that that money's not really as much as we'd like it to be.
No, I think that's really, I think there's a good long form piece for someone to write about how, if you look at the staff salaries, there's a reason why the SEC is what it is, even compared to like the Big Ten and Pac-12 and whatnot. Like, those conferences obviously probably pay more per team than like Syracuse does, and a lot more than like a MAC school does. But the SEC is at a whole nother level in terms of coordinator and staff salaries. So I think that's really where the most tangible gap is. And Syracuse is definitely most likely on the low end of what the Power Five pays. So that's definitely an issue. Overall, I think the most the biggest differentiator is, you know, he spent this time at Towson. It does give us potentially a presence in the Mid-Atlantic and in the, you know, the DMV, which is somewhere where we've really not done much work at all in recent years. And it's very talent heavy, and it's not that far away. So I wonder what his connections there are. Obviously, he coached there just now. And I think people do get worried about like the lower level stuff. But when you're a recruiter, you're recruiting the same schools, whether you're recruiting a D1, an FBS kid, an FCS kid, a D2 kid. You're building the same relationships. And if you have a good relationship from recruiting the FCS level kids at these schools, when they have a Power 5 type kid, you already have those inroads. So I think, you know, it's definitely something you'd prefer to have all these, you know, powerhouse ACC Big Ten recruiters. But if you're coach and recruit, and he's built those connections, I think there's ground that can be made up pretty easily by having the good relationships. So hopefully he's a guy with those. I think you're muted, John.
Sorry. I think it's going back to the same problems we were talking about kind of in the comments. After Syracuse earlier this week hired Wake Forest, you know, high school relations director, a.k.a. recruiting coordinator, Asiel Mulba, and people were talking about Eric White's Rolodex versus Mulba's when Mulba is 2 years older, has been in a non-Syracuse Power 5 school for a little while. The whole thing was, I wasn't claiming that Mulba was a better option than White. I was just claiming that, you know, how is Mulba worse? And it just seemed like there's such a dedication to this Rolodex. Like, everybody has a lot of similar Rolodexes, and the fact of the matter is a lot of the kids we're talking to, the only reason that talks didn't progress with Bowling Green past a certain point with the current staff was because Bowling Green was not in a Power 5 conference. And you're seeing, as soon as these, you know, coaches head over to Syracuse, suddenly they're able to reopen these avenues with a lot of these kids. And that's not something that should be discounted. Again, like you just said, you're talking to the same coaches, you're establishing the same relationships no matter what school you're at. And obviously, if the same coaching staff goes up to a better job, you know, you have more entitled, like, you've already done the legwork of establishing a relationship with the kid, with the coaches. Now you're selling the new school and the better school, and you have a better proposition for them. So to me, like, I just, there's an awful lot of questioning of this staff, and I don't know if it's, you know, in part, whether the site's kind of negative bend toward Schaefer's staff at the end, or the fan base's negative bend towards Schaefer's staff at the end. But I feel like there's a lot of people that are still like way on edge, and are willing to doubt anything that that a Syracuse coach says, at least as far as football is concerned.
I think it's a strange combination. Like it's a strange like pairing of bedfellows of people that were very, very loyal to Schaefer and that are still mad that he got fired, which is whatever. And then also people who were very, very happy to fire Schaefer, but then think that we brought in a Mac, a Mac caliber coaching staff, and see it as a, obviously the style and whatnot are way different, but they think it's just like another Schaefer that focuses on offense instead of defense. So I think both of those sides, which should be like kind of vehemently like opposite, are kind of both voicing negative opinions about the same things, which is interesting. At least that's my read on it.
Yeah, I think we're just a weird fan base, and that includes us. So we don't want to make it seem like we're pointing fingers at others. The weird fan base commentary goes to literally all of us, and probably will to the end of time. Dan, and to wrap us up, I guess, who are some recruits that you're a little high on? And again, no worries if you haven't really done a ton of digging on this yet. But some recruits that you're a little high on that are going to be visiting Syracuse in the next couple weeks. I mean, there's a long list of, 23 plus at this point that are going to be here sometime in January.
I'm trying to open up and find the visits just because there's a crazy number of players coming. I really like... Sorry, my headset fell out.
Oh, good.
I really like a lot of the guys that are already committed. Just for, I think it's a pretty good sign when one staff... Oh, my God, I can't keep this thing in. when one staff recruits someone, and obviously it does seem like the Baber staff came in and wasn't married to any of them, and... The fact that they've kept the guys they've kept, I think, is a positive. And I think when we saw Marone take over for Robinson, and unfortunately this is now rehashed because of Robinson stuff this week, but I think Marone only kept like four commits from Robinson, and like they were, I think a couple of them were like Justin Pugh and Alec Lemon. So like they're really, Marone didn't have a lot of faith in what Robinson was doing because he let go most of them, but the ones he kept turned out to be really good. So I always think, Babers had no reason to hang on to the ones he did. But obviously I think he communicated that he really liked the ones that are still around. So I'm a big fan of Sam Heckel. I think he's going to be really good. I like kind of Midwestern linemen. It seems like he has a really nice frame to build on. One of the guys that we've been in on forever, Kentrell Moran, he's like a 3-4-star kid. I think he is still an Illinois commit, although it seems like it's been shaky for a while, but he has really good offers. But just seems like he's a really solid running back, and one that, both staffs were recruiting heavily. So it just seems like he's been on the radar for so long, and he's been on the verge of maybe flipping. Just really want to get him in. I'm trying to go through this list. The California kids are all really interesting to me. Devon Cooper, Sean Riley, like they're, I think just building that pipeline and kind of bridging that relationship with that staff. And obviously, a couple of these kids were guys that were committed to Arizona, and so a pretty solid program there wanted them. So I feel good about them, and I'm interested to see how these two weekends go, since there are so many players coming in, and I do expect that you'll see like a huge rush of commitments after both of these weekends, just because it seems like the staff is going all in on making their big push to fill out the class, since it has been kind of gutted recently, and obviously there haven't been commitments recently because of the dead period and the lack of contact. So I'm excited. I think we're going to see a lot of action once we get these guys to campus.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that there's a lot to watch out for kind of this Saturday and Sunday, with a big group coming into town, especially those California kids. The California kids are interesting because I know that for the most part, Syracuse tries to, go for recruits that there's going to be direct flights to Syracuse from, and Los Angeles is not one of those places, at least not to my knowledge. Usually for LA, you're going to need to stop somewhere, even if it's JFK, and take a hopper. But still, you know what? If because the relationship's there, I mean, Sean Riley has some decent Mountain West interest, and obviously, you know, had the Arizona offer, but with the gray shirt nonsense, he's out. Cooper has a really nice roster of offers, and if he's as committed to playing with Riley as it seems, I think this could be a huge get for SU as we're looking to add some speed, add some additional playmakers on the offensive side. Another player who I think is a huge key to all this is Drew Beasley. You know, he's from De La Salle High School over in Warren, Michigan. We added Michigan guys specifically. For guys like Drew Beasley, it seems, based on everything we've heard, that Beasley is pretty high in SU and really just wants to get a feel for everything before committing. But the bigger part of that is that he's also friends with Desmond Fitzpatrick. Stephen Bailey had a really great article about Fitzpatrick on Wednesday. And Fitzpatrick is super high on SU. He's super high on Mike Hart. And if Hart can help land, you know, a four-star receiver like Fitzpatrick, who has a ton of offers, and if Beasley helps that too, I mean, that would be enormous, and I think put to rest a lot of fears that some might have about the you know, kind of converted MAC guys that some feel like are all we're recruiting. That's not true. I mean, Kenneth Ruff's already on campus, and he was a three-star Virginia linebacker who grades out really well and probably is a perfect fit for the Tampa too. I think a lot of the guys you mentioned are great. I'm very interested to see what happens with Stuart Reese. Florida State's a favorite, so obviously we're dealing with a very talented player here. I don't think we get him, but it's always good to be in those conversations, especially someone who has the size. I mean, he's 6'7", 335. A guy who already has, you know, NFL-level talent. I really do think we need to do a little bit more work now on the defensive back front. I think as much as the staff might not be super high on him, I wouldn't doubt it if you saw Devin Clark get an offer that he can actually commit to this time around, just because there's not a ton of defensive backs on this list, and especially not a ton that I think we're really, really in on. I think Evan Foster and Clark seem like the two best options ahead to us. So again, I think he gets an offer and I think he commits because he's really been high on Syracuse since day one and really has not wanted to go anywhere else. It's a long-winded way of saying that some of my favorites and that you know, again, we're in for a couple of big weekends, just like you had said earlier.
Yeah, I agree on Clark. I think you know, he's just been in the, you know, he's been on the radar for so long, and he does seem like a guy who is pretty invested. So, and I think we just kind of need DBs. So even if he's, you know, not an A-level guy, I mean, if he's someone that the staff thinks they can bring in, maybe develop, but just having more bodies in that position, honestly, is important at this point, because we've seen what happens when Syracuse gets low on DBs. It was pretty ugly this year.
Agreed. And yeah, that's a thing. I mean, you and I have talked about the depth issues numerous times, but when you have depth issues and talent issues, at least at the top of the depth chart, it isn't like these things, you know, can't improve. I mean, these kids are going to improve, especially with the amount of reps they were getting on the field. But I think we just need depth, more open competition going into this coming fall to see who can play. One kid I wanted to touch on, Anna, before we left here, you know, Devin Modster, another kid who decommitted from Arizona. He's super, and you know, he's four-star. He's got interest all over the board. UCLA is the favorite, but Dan, do you think we have any shot? I know a lot of people say no. There's some, you know, more vocal fans that say yes. Do you think there's any chance here?
I don't know. I wouldn't give it a huge chance, but if you get someone on campus, I think there's always, you know, they could always fall in love with the school and the staff and everything. So I'll feel a lot better if they get them on a visit. But, you know, coming from California, obviously it's, you know, a bit iffy that, you know, you sell a kid on coming from there to play at Syracuse. But we've done it before, and obviously there are a handful of others who are interested in making a similar trip. So There's definitely a chance, but this kid, you know, he's a pretty big-time player. It would say a lot about what people think about Dino Babers' system and him as a coach if he gets him. So I'm rooting for it, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't call it like a failure if he doesn't land him or if we don't make a cut or whatever. I think it's nice to be involved, and he does seem to be taking us, you know, fairly seriously, even though we just got involved in the last couple weeks.
Same here, and you know what? I think it's unfortunate. The one knock I will have on it is that if Monster is able to set up his visit for this weekend with the other kids from the Los Angeles area, I mean, Rancho Santa Margarita is from down in Orange County. It's not exactly right next door, but to have a couple other kids there from the same general area, I think would have spoken volumes. I know it helped us when we had that big crop of Georgia kids. We've had the New Jersey kids in the past. Having them all come up together just kind of created a little bit more camaraderie, especially, I mean, the New Jersey kids, it's one thing, you're a couple hours away, but for the Georgia kids or for California kids or you know, Miami kids, bringing them up as a group and having them kind of, you know, find all that in common with each other right away and seeing all of them come from the same background and similar situations and similar climate, et cetera. Seeing them all see the same things in Syracuse, I think, has been a big boost. And, you know, that's one thing that we might see with the Michigan and Illinois kids this weekend. But in general, I think would have been a nice boost for the California kids as well.
Yeah, definitely easier to see, you know, to make a big move like that when you're not the only one. So will be interesting. I think you can kind of see that with how many kids from these different spots all kind of group together and build their own relationships. So it'll be cool if the California kids do something similar, but, you know, I'm not going to be too depressed if they don't land them here on the first go around. But overall, I think there's some really interesting players coming to campus, and I think we're going to get like one. I think we're going to land a fish that people get pretty excited about. I just have a feeling that there's at least one of these pretty big recruits is going to be sold, and that'll kind of get people going, because I do think that this dead period has kind of killed some of the momentum of, you know, with the fan base, not really what's happening out on the recruiting trail, but people do seem to be a little hungry for a big commitment from Babers, and he's been in the program for a while, and outside of the UNC halftime thing, there hasn't been a lot from him. He's kind of been quiet as the coach so far, which is fine, because he's just been doing what he needs to do. But I do think that there could, you know, we could use something to kind of get the fan base pumped, and I wouldn't be shocked if we have a pretty big commitment in the next couple weeks. And that's not me knowing anything. I just, you know, just feels like that's going to happen for me.
I would agree. I think that's a good place to wrap up. Dan, anything else before we sign off for the week?
No, just trying to get through these next couple weeks until signing day. I think we have a lot of room in this class where we didn't, you know, a couple weeks ago when Schaefer was still here. So I think they're going to be a busy couple weeks.
Agreed. And on that note, you've been listening to Troy Nunes. It's an absolute podcast. That was Dan. I'm John. Please be sure to rate, review, subscribe on Blog Talk and on iTunes. And yeah, go Orange this weekend.
Go Orange.